Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's cooker weather right now, isn't it? Not the 100 degree boiling hot water, but the chilled sparkling water for me. Can you believe I have sparkling water straight from my kitchen tap? Sparkling water on tap. It's a wonderful invention. I also love the fact they sponsor this podcast. Great people, great product, great company. Also environmentally friendly, because once they've heated the water, they keep it hot through a vacuum. For more information and to look at the models, go to cooker.co.uk. Today's hour, I'm curious about how you run a truly sustainable company. Regular listeners will remember I spoke to Kate Raworth recently about donut economics. It's a new type of economics where you judge success by other metrics rather than just growth. She was discussing sustainability. It's worth listening to that if you get a chance. Today, I'm speaking to Amelia Gammon, who has set up a company called Bide. Bide was founded in the roots of intersectional environmentalism, built to support the planet and the people that inhabit it. This is from their website. They wanted to start a business that could be truly sustainable, providing a solution for the climate and social crisis. Rather than me tell you about it, I'll let Amelia fill us in. Just before I do, again, regular listeners will know I like talking to people about their businesses. Obviously, it can come across as a bit of an advert, but I won't apologize for that. I like the product. I like the company, but I think you're smart enough to decide whether you buy these products for yourself or not. I'm not forcing you to do it. If you fancy it, try it. I learned a lot doing this, by the way. Let's meet her. Here's Amelia. Amelia, hello. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. I think the best way to start this is to first of all tell us about your brand, and then maybe we could get into some more details about you, and then your aspirations and everything else. So tell us a bit about Bide. Is it Bide Planet or Bide? Which one do you go with?
Do you know what, we are happy to take any. We're an interplay between the two, but essentially Bide is a social enterprise that is rethinking the way that environmentally sound goods are produced. So we are here to tackle marginalisation, but also the climate crisis in one fell swoop.
Right. Okay. So let's hear a bit about you then. So, by the way, I've had some of your products because you've sent me the sample package, and I do really like them. It's really good.
Oh, that's good.
So it's a good product, and we'll get into that in a minute. But how did you decide to get involved in it? What is your history? Where were you working, and what happened to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've had a number of careers. My first career was as a dancer. I did a degree at university. I started dancing around the world, ran out of money, went to London, got a job making tea for a sales desk at a large media company, and fell into a media career. So I spent 20 years working for some of the biggest film and TV companies, working for quite possibly some of the most awful individuals who had lots and lots of money and weren't doing the right things with it. And I guess I just had this kind of massive conscience crisis, partly when I grew up, partly when I started having a family. I kind of looked around at what I was doing and thinking, I've made a huge amount of money for people that aren't making any purposeful impact with it. I can't keep doing that. And at the same time, as a consummate business professional flying around the world, Monday to Friday, the weekends, I'd take off my stilettos, walk barefoot around London, and was the kind of a closet hippie. And those two worlds finally collided, and that's really how Bide became.
Do you think the people who, because I work in the entertainment industry, there's a lot of very uncouth spending of money in my industry, but I'm not sure it's their fault. I think about things. And one of my mates at the moment is can't stop going on holiday. And I said, mate, if you buy a house you like living in, you won't have to keep running away abroad constantly. And he got really angry about it. But I do believe that, you know. I mean, I often find when I go away, it's not as nice as where I live and my house and the environment I built around myself. So I'm always like, I can't wait to get home again. I think that's one of the important things to do. But I'm not sure it's people's fault, because they're taught, aren't they, to be successful in life is actually to have two houses, to, you know, to go on expensive holidays, to buy a Bentley, and to, you know, the blah 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 blah. And all they're doing is they're sort of trying to achieve what they've been taught to achieve without questioning it. Do you think that?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And in fact, I was completely tied up in that way of thinking whilst I was, in the middle of media. I had a great job. I had a fantastic title. I was flown business class around the world. I'd have limousines pick me up. And I was completely immersed in it. And actually, if I'm going to be really honest with myself, I only started buying when the pandemic happened, because I had had such a good career. I was worried that if I did something under my own steam and it failed, that my reputation and that I had associated with my career would be tarnished. And so it was a cowardly way to start a new business, because I knew that everyone was distracted by the pandemic. So if it didn't work, no one would notice.
That's interesting. At least you're being honest with yourself there. And I suppose it's tough as well if you've got such a great job to actually pivot to do something else. It's like leaving the old life behind. It must be kind of an unsure moment for you when you do that.
Yeah, it's absolutely uncertain. But it's also financially has been incredibly uncertain for me and my family. I've been paid well for the majority of my career. I now don't pay myself anything. So we are financing ourselves through renting out our house 2 weekends of every month. I have 4 young children, so we pack up all their toys and go and kind of sofa surf for 2 weekends of every month. So yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty, both in terms of courage and conviction, but also financially, that I've actually thrown not only myself but my whole family into in order to pursue Bide.
So how long can you do that for? By the way, I don't think you'll be doing it for very long. I think, you know, I've been looking at the business and I think it's exciting and I think people will very soon buy into it. But how long do you think you could do that for? How long have you given yourself before you have to go, right, I'm back in there.
Do you know what?
Back in the circus.
When I started it, I said, right, I'm going to give myself 18 months. And then, you know, and then we'll kind of review things. We're now 2 years in, and actually I'm not going to ever give myself an end date. The impact that we're having as an organization, the kind of support and pickup that we're having, shows me the momentum is there. And this is definitely something that I have to keep pursuing until we get to the kind of the ambition and the scale that I want for this company. So actually there's no longer an end date. We're in, and we're just going to keep pursuing.
It's exciting, isn't it? I mean, I've sort of jumped on the I want to say bandwagon, but that's the wrong word, but I've kind of tried my hardest in my life to try and become as environmentally friendly as possible, and I think every time I see something, I think if it suits my life, I think it's exciting. So the idea that I'm, you know, your products, it excites me the way it comes, it's packaged, and excites me the way that you've made them, because I feel the genie's out of the bottle in a lot of things. I don't think we can go backwards. We have to go forwards. And it feels to me you're going forwards, not backwards, with the way you're doing it. I suppose we should get even more details about the company. Explain the products, how you make them and how it works.
Yeah, sure. So right now we have a range of eco-cleaning products. They're all made from vegan, non-toxic, UK-sourced raw ingredients, the majority of which are actually food-grade materials. But instead of us making our products in factories, we bring factories to the kitchen tables of people across the UK. These people are people who've historically been marginalised. So they are prison leavers, refugees, single parents, carers, people with disabilities, retirees. We found them either through word of mouth or through strategic partnerships that we have with employment charities. And we essentially are creating a kind of future of work solution for unskilled labour. So while there's a huge amount of innovation going on for future of work, for people who have skills, who are a kind of a certain stage in their careers, we are providing that solution for people who haven't. So we have a kind of no questions asked policy for people joining our home manufacturing network. So we don't ask for a CV, we don't have any formal interview, we don't ask for any prior experience. We simply ask that they can make the goods to the high standards that we and our customers expect. So we sent them a really small box, and in that box are the raw ingredients to make each of our products and some printed materials, where we work with Breaking Barriers, which is a refugee employment charity. We also localise the language of those instructions for people who don't have English as a first language. They make our products in their home. We collect them. We then test them against our quality control tests. And if they meet our standards, that's it. They're onboarded. They tell us how much work they want. They never have to leave their home. And that's really, really important, actually, because these people historically have struggled to get work because they don't fit with this common idea of what work is, which is essentially that you get up, you leave your home and go to a place of work. if you have a disability or if you have sole responsibility for someone in the caring capacity, you just don't do that. And so historically, they've been overlooked and haven't been seen as active participants of local economies. So by bringing everything to them, we're basically lifting all those barriers that have prevented them from working in the past and making it very simple for them to do so.
With no questions asked, I've just been reading a book actually on media and especially the news. And in the news, they're always searching for monsters in society. That's one of their jobs, is to look around and try and find monsters. And they keep telling us that that is their job. Now, if you're asking no questions to anyone you're employed, at some stage, someone, a monster, or the way they describe a monster in the media, is going to work for you. And if they can connect it to a company, then they can throw a negative light on it. Is that a worry to you? You know, I've got a bad person making my stuff and it connects it to Bide Planet, if there's no questions ever asked.
No, because I think the opportunity for us to be able to unearth incredibly passionate, hardworking people who deserve an opportunity is so much greater motivation than the fear of one of those people, you know, being this monster that you describe. We've had, we've had over 300 applications to be home manufacturers. We're oversubscribed to people wanting to work with us in an environment where everyone else is hitting the headlines saying we can't find workers. These people, from our experience so far, are so passionate, not only about what they're doing for themselves in terms of earning money, but in terms of being part of this kind of environmental movement, that they go above and beyond to support our business. So I would always, always kind of push our agenda to reach those people, even with the risk of, you know, one of these people that you've described being associated with the company.
What about health and safety conditions and things like that as well, if you're getting people to work from home? Because, you know, there's very few things I can... I remember when we had to start doing shooting on TV in a car park, right? There'd be no cars in the car park. The car park would be shut. And yet all the camera crew and everyone would still have to wear high vis vests. I was like, what is going to hit you? A UFO? I mean, it's like, I had literally no idea why they were doing it, but they were like, you know, it's the rules, it's the laws. So when people are working at home, is that, does that become a response? I'm only asking these questions. I'm fascinated by your business. I love it. But is that become a, it's your responsibility to make sure that they're working in a safe environment, even though it's their own house, because they're working for you?
Yeah, so they're all self-employed. So just to make that incredibly clear, so we support them with what's involved with being a self-employed person. So there is a degree of them saying, we acknowledge that we are going to work in a clean, clear environment, that we're going to have ventilation, that we're going to use the kind of equipment that you provide us with. So we provide them with gloves and we provide them with masks. The method of making our products only actually needs a whisk and a bowl and a set of weighing scales. So there's no complex heating of materials, there is no complex machinery that's needed, there's no cutting, there's no sharp utensils. So we have designed our formulation to make sure that the possible impact on our home manufacturers is minimized as much as possible. And as I mentioned before, the majority of our ingredients are food grade, the exception being the essential oils that we use to fragrance. So the exposure to them is very, very limited. It's working with materials that you would normally find in your food cupboard, like bicarbonate of soda, for example, if you were making a cake.
It's like Breaking Bad, isn't it? I'm just cooking up something in my kitchen, but not crystal meth.
It's toilet scrub,
dishwasher. So I can't get my head around it. What actually are they actually doing in their kitchen? Because I've used your washing powder and the dishwasher I've used. I haven't used your actual washing up liquid yet, because I've still got some fairy left and I'm not going to waste that. So I'll do
no,
that
you
for
definitely
you.
Not waste it.
Frowning upon the fairy liquid there. So what are they manufacturing in their kitchens? What do we actually see and how are they making it? Let's take, for instance, the dishwasher stuff. What actually is it?
So it's a combination. We don't have any more than 5 ingredients in any of our products. So we send them approximately 25 kilogram sacks of each of the raw ingredients needed to make dishwasher powder. They effectively weigh the ingredients into a bowl. They mix it with a whisk or a wooden spoon by hand. They then leave the dishwasher powder for a couple of hours. They go back in, they add some essential oils, mix it up again till it becomes a fine powder. They then take our packaging. So we use, you'll have seen this, but we have craft paper pouch packaging. So unlike most branded products where they say, let's make this look as beautiful as possible so that we can really attract our audience to buy this product, we have done the opposite and said, right, we don't care what it looks like. What's important is what's in the inside of the package. We have designed this for end of life, which means that we've designed it to make sure it has the lowest possible environmental mental impact once you finish with it. So our pouches are 100% pre-recycled. They're lined with a plant cellulose. They're ziplocked with starch. So when you finish using the product, rinse it out, dig a hole in your window box, shove it in, put some soil over and grow some flowers. Like it's so gentle because it's home compostable. So the home manufacturers take that pouch. They write their name on the back of it so you know who made your product. They then fill it with the packet of the product, and we then collect it and check it and then distribute it to our end consumer.
You say you don't care what it looks like, but it looks very cool. It's very now.
Oh, I'm glad you think it looks cool.
Oh, no, it is. My daughter walked in the house after I had it, and she's 9, and I've had it. She's very excited by it, by the way, because obviously education these days is teaching children constantly about the environment. And she sees the packaging, and she looks at it, and she's like, oh, this is great. Can I open them? Starts opening them all and looking at it all and everything else. And so she was very excited by it. I think the simplicity of it is what, and I was as well. I think the simplicity of it, look, I hate single-use plastic, and I think a lot of us do now. It's a necessary evil for a lot of us, but I do think it's something that we're very conscious of. And I think, you know, when we're looking constantly, we buy, I don't know, strawberries or something, and it comes in that, you're always like, oh, why can't we understand why it comes in that? But there's also this massive guilt feeling of why can't it come in just brown paper or something that's you know, that you can compost, you know, as you say. But so I think the packaging's great. How much input did you have on the actual designs on it? I think that the simplicity of it is wonderful.
Yeah, so that actually was me and my best mate in the garden, like during the pandemic, trying to kind of figure out the best way for us to display that the message of what we're doing is more important than the brand itself. So there's a huge amount of humility associated with Bide, which is why it's a lowercase b. Because actually it's less about the brand and more about the people behind us that are making all these products, that are kind of going above and beyond to try and make a change to the situation they're in. But I think that, you know, from a, it's really interesting that you say that you like the packaging, and because actually it was entirely driven by making it simple. The problem is that the packaging that we've chosen is quite expensive. So going back to your strawberry point, actually, unfortunately, plastic boxes for strawberries are much cheaper than mushroom made boxes for strawberries. And, you know, that's the problem that we're competing with at the moment, is that more responsible packaging options are incredibly more expensive than single use plastic.
I do think, though, as consumers, we've become obsessed with cheap. But I think it could change if the right, like the companies like yours came out and the message was there, and you understand that they're going to be a bit more because the packaging costs a bit more. By the way, my daughter was, one of the things we had was done by Peter, and my daughter went, do you know Peter made this, Dad? And I just thought that was really funny. It became, it had sort of had an identity to it. I know it's a lot of women who do stuff, but clearly you employ men as well. And it's just, it was just, I thought that was fascinating that she had actually sort of spotted that on the packaging and thought that was interesting, and she could suddenly sort of, there was an, it's like a Marvel, there was an origin story behind my dishwasher powder. Peter,
you know,
the dishwasher,
yeah, actually,
maker.
Peter is one of four men, so he is like the, they are the minority. We made that decision originally. I said this is for women only, and then we realized that actually it wasn't inclusive for us to preclude men or people who identify as male. So we have four men, but those kind of origin stories are a really important part of how we attract customers and also keep them with us, because we share the stories of the people making the product. I think it's really impactful for people to understand why people have chosen to do this type of work in their own homes. And actually, I'm sure he won't mind me telling you, but he was a highly accomplished lecturer, had a brain injury and couldn't work, and now our type of work is what suits him and his current kind of health condition. And so he's incredibly passionate and very vocal. We have quarterly meetings with all of the home manufacturers so that they can tell us their ideas, or we can ask them how we're doing as kind of partners. And he's a very kind of vocal part of that community.
And you say you have to check the quality control. Sadly, with every business and everything, there's always going to be a wrong one, I suppose. And I wonder if there's somebody who's, I'm not saying you have got anyone, but you're saying you have to check the quality before it goes out. How can you do that when it's just a powder? Is there a way that you sample batch it or something? How does that work?
So every batch has a sample bag within it. So we basically use it as you would in your own home. So the washing up liquid, we will dilute it and we will wash some dishes in our warehouse and we'll see that it's foaming, that it smells correctly, that it's, you know, keeping the right type of stabilization in the formula when it's left on shelf. We also control batch sizing. So we only give larger batches to home manufacturers that have consistently given us high quality work. So you get rewarded with more work the better the products that you produce, which also helps mitigate risk. Because if there is somebody that for whatever reason has put something wrong in or isn't doing it in the right way, we're not then exposed. If you look at a normal factory setting, the throughput of products is thousands per minute. If something goes wrong in that factory line, that's thousands of products that have been affected. But our batch sizing is in quantities of 50x. So we're always kind of mitigating the risk.
How do you know it works? I mean, how do you find out about these things? What knowledge do you have to have? Because I've never thought about what was in fairy liquid, because I just used it because that's what you buy in the shops, and it's sort of just an anti-grease thing as far as I can work out. Don't know what I'm putting on my plates, but how do you know what this ingredient is and how it works? What's the science behind it all?
So we work with external formulation specialists, and we give them very specific briefs to say nothing can contain palm oil. Everything has to derive from a UK source. We don't use any false fragrances, no parabens, no phthalates, no animal tested products. And they go away and come up with a formulation that kind of fits those conditions. We then set them the next challenge and say, okay, nothing has to be heated. Everything has to be non-toxic and safe. And the formulation has to include simple mixing. So it is an incredibly complex process to get to where we get to. But I think the fundamental point is that actually you only need a few basic ingredients to make these type of products. And when you look at the back of the packages of the other products that you probably have in your kitchen cupboard, most of the rest of the ingredients are to keep the appearance looking consistent. So the fairy liquid to look that kind of green or lemon colour, yellow colour, to make sure that when you've had it in your cupboard for a while, it continues to pour in the same way. Things that actually don't improve the effectiveness of its cleaning capacity. It's more about making sure as a consumer you're happy that it looks good and as you would expect.
Yeah, what is it though? What is cleaning it? What's actually happening? Sorry, I might be asking you questions that you don't know.
No, it's fine. So we basically do, but yeah. So we basically use the main kind of cleaning agent are either releasing the bond between dirt and the material that you're cleaning. And then the second kind of function of the cleaning is to then wash it away so that it's cleaned. So those are the two kind of functions of any cleaning products. Right. We use coconut-based surfactants to do that. So we're using vegan kind of plant-derived ingredients in order to do that rather than kind of extreme chemical compounds. So one of them will break down the bond, the other will then release it from the material that water can then wash it away.
Are you still offering free sample packages where they just pay for their postage to get a...
Yeah.
Get it? Right, yeah. Okay. So how do people do that, just if they've got to this stage and they're getting their appetite... They're watching the how would they go about doing that?
So if they head to our website by planet.com, then they can just order samples and pay £1.54. And then the samples will be sent out to them. They get three or four washes of each of our products, and then they can try it before they make any commitment.
What does success mean to you?
So success for me is a system, an infrastructure on a global scale that provides work for people that are normally overlooked. So 34% of the global population is made up of refugees, prison leavers, people without a permanent home, people that are kind of conventionally classed as being marginalized. Success for me is finding and developing a solution that every individual can get work if they want to, which means that by Kite Mark will appear on the back of other people's packaging. So right now we produce our own goods. We've got a cleaning range. We're moving into body care. So we will soon be launching a hand wash and a body wash that will be available using the same kind of principles that we've already established. And then going forward, you know, if we were to touch base in 5 years, I would expect I'd be telling you that you can find our brand on the back of other people's products, because they know that making things through our home manufacturing network has the highest standards of ethics and environmental credentials.
I haven't opened my washing up liquid yet, but it's a powder that I dilute, isn't it?
It's not. It's actually a liquid.
Oh, is it?
That was liquid that you dilute. Oh, yeah.
And it's a liquid I dilute. Right.
Okay. Yeah, but it's also in a paper bag.
Yes.
Yes.
It is. Yes, it is. That's why I assumed it was a powder. So I haven't opened that yet. I love the idea of diluting it. I think that's really smart. Why do we need it already diluted? Surely it's more of a strain on the environment. Are you enjoying doing this?
I'm absolutely loving it. I'm absolutely loving it. It's, you know, I've been passionate about planet and people since I was a tiny kid, and I just hid it and suppressed it and got on with kind of being part of this rat race. And I feel incredibly blessed and liberated that I can now do this day in, day out. And it's also, you know, there's a real kind of, going back to being like really honest about it, it's a bit of an ego boost when you get emails from people talking about how you're kind of changing their lives. Like, there can't be any better motivation for working than receiving that type of kind of feedback. So, yeah, I'm kind of living my best possible life right now.
Do you enjoy being a business owner? Are you enjoying being a boss? Are you enjoying looking after staff?
Do you know what? It's funny that you say that, because there's a group of women at one of our warehouses, and they call me boss because they know that it winds me up so badly. I hate it. I hate having to use the word CEO. It doesn't fit right with me at all. I strongly believe that people left to their own devices are the best possible versions of themselves. So, you know, managing people, I don't really see it like that. I see like that I'm working alongside them. And I feel incredibly lucky that I've kind of got this wonderful group of people from a completely diverse set of backgrounds that are all working together. And then through the home manufacturing network, we've actually got this massive team of people that are involved. In a company of our size 2 years in, we probably wouldn't normally have this number of people involved in our business. So I feel incredibly fortunate.
Yeah, I once started up a business which didn't do too well in the end, but I just found the pressure of looking at people had kids and families and stuff, and I found that pressure of going to sleep every night thinking, oh God, if this doesn't work, then how are they going to, you know, how are we going to make the money? And it didn't work. Everything's fine. Everybody's fine. Everybody's fine. And everybody's gone on to have a great go. But every night I was lying there in bed going, I don't know what to do. How am I going to make this thing work? And it just wasn't. I couldn't stand the pressure of it. You know, that people relying on me. I'm not sure I'd ever do it again.
Yeah, it is tough. But I think that my years of working in kind of big corporates, I always had sales roles that had very large kind of targets attached to my responsibility. And I think that's really kind of hardened me to be able to get on with something like this. So I'm not someone that worries at night. I'm somebody that annoyingly hits my head on the pillow, goes straight to sleep, wakes up very early the next morning, ready to start again. I'm lucky that I don't have that kind of thought process. I think it's much bigger than me. This is a much bigger issue than myself. And I think that's the other thing that just kind of keeps me kind of settled to say it's not about what I'm feeling about the situation, because I'm representing so many more people.
You've also got 4 kids, did you say, and a business. So no wonder you fall straight to sleep with you. Did you say you had 4 kids?
I do. I have, I just need to think about how old they are, because they've all just had birthdays. So I have a 8-year-old, a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 2-year-old.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
That's that keeps you and your husband going, I imagine.
I don't have a husband, I have a wife.
Sorry. Oh, sorry.
I have a wife instead.
Oh, cool. Excellent stuff. Let's talk about the future. Do you think the country is, do you think it's coming round to sustainability? Do you think we are moving in the right direction, or are you frustrated that we're not?
I'm probably going to say yes to both of those questions. I don't like to use the word sustainability very often. I prefer to use the word responsibility, because as a human race, we're just simply not sustainable. We haven't been since we've moved out of caves. I think that we are moving in the right direction for being more responsible at every layer of society. So whether it be at a government level, large institutions, and then on a personal kind of consumer level, we are moving in the right direction. Does it frustrate me? Yes. I don't think that we started that journey soon enough. And as a result, I think that it's going to be very hard for us to catch up with ourselves. I think that the responsibility for brand owners and for anybody kind of delivering consumer products is probably the greatest responsibility of them all, because we're the people that have that direct relationship with people's purses and have the ability to help them make the right spending decisions. And I think that's ultimately what's going to push this further and at a greater speed.
Do you think it's confusing for the consumer?
It's incredibly confusing. I mean, greenwashing, social washing, goodness knows what washing is going to come out next. And it's obviously not helped by the fact that those with the big marketing budgets can, you know, slap a plant leaf on the front of their ads and everyone thinks that they're being vegan or plant friendly, and actually they aren't. And it's a tricky one. I think that that has to be a policy level. I think that we need the Advertising Standards Authority and others to come in and say, actually, they are starting to do that. So there is a new ad standards that's coming in, that if you make a claim about being environmentally friendly and you're not, then you can get fined for that. But that is a kind of retroactive process. It doesn't prevent you from making that ad in the first place. It means that you'll be penalised afterwards. So I think that the confusion for consumers is definitely there. I think that the scaremongering around the climate crisis in media is not helping either, because it puts consumers under a huge amount of pressure that they know that they have to do something. If they aren't shown clearly how they can do that, then everyone just freezes. It's kind of like a, you know, it's like a fight or flight moment. And most people just kind of flee because it's just too overwhelming to think about it. And that's the other thing that's really important for us as a business, is that we will never tell anybody they're doing anything wrong. We will always say that we are developing things in a responsible way. You can trust us that we've made the right decisions. Come to us if you want to, but don't feel forced to do so, because it's only when an individual feels safe and informed that they will make a change that will be consistent and will be sustained over a period of time.
Yeah, I'm always a big believer in you should be for things, not against things. I've said this a few times on this podcast, that I think one of the biggest problems with this sort of area we talk about, it's all very negative, you know, the world's about to be destroyed and, you know, everything's going to be, everything, our children are not going to have anywhere to live and we're running out of time. And it's also very Hollywood stuff. And I think it maybe needs a subtle change. Like, as I say, your products arrive in my house, my daughter immediately goes, oh, I like these, and I like them because I feel it's good for the planet, it's good for us as a family, so I enjoyed having the products. I'll tell you what, it's interesting, I'm going solar fitted this week. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now I've got an e-bike, which I ride more than anything. I've got a normal bike, I ride a lot, then I've got an e-bike when I'm going on long journeys. I've got an electric car, which I hardly ever use. But what's fascinating about all this is I'm going to have it powered by the sun soon. And I think that is so bloody exciting. I'm like in bloody Star Trek or something. Do you know what I mean? I'm like living in the future. I'm like this incredible person. Now, fortunately, I've got they did a discount thing in London, so I jumped on that and I had enough money to do it. But I'm like, this is amazing. Hopefully, if it works out as they say it will, I won't have to use any fossil fuels to fuel my life. I'm actually taking energy off the big yellow thing in the sky. Now, apparently, I've not thought it through, because in a couple of billion years, it's not going to be there. But whilst it's there, I just think it's so bloody exciting. Now, the way it's solar sold to everyone is, oh, the world's dying and, you know, get solar, rather than you could be living in the future like Tim and actually, you know,
like Tim, that should be the ad campaign.
Like Tim, get the power from the sun. I just think it's unbelievably exciting. And I think any new build out there, I spoke to a friend of mine who's an estate agent. I said, is there any reason I shouldn't get solar? And he goes, no, people love it. And I spoke to my builder and said, any reason why I shouldn't do it? And he said, a guy I know who's a builder, by the way, he did some work in my house. And he said to me, no, I'm doing it in my house. And it's like people are getting excited about it because they like the idea of it being powered by the sun. And I think, because, you know, the government should say any new builds got to be solar, maybe cost a bit more, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. We're going to power ourselves by natural energy. And I just was in Brighton the other day looking at all those windmills going, you know, I know there's a lot of people go, oh, they're ugly. I was just going, that's amazing. Look at all those windmills out there in the by the coast, which we all know is very windy. What a great idea. I think it's exciting. And I think it's so sold in negativity rather than excitement. I think that's a problem. Sorry, long rant there.
But no, it's really good.
Do you see what I mean? It's exciting getting your products through. It's not like, oh, I'm saving the planet. It's like, just these are brilliant. These are exciting.
Yeah, we have. So we left London 4 years ago, and we bought an old chapel in rural Wiltshire, and I've converted it into an eco home. So we have solar. We have the most ridiculous battery pack set up in the loft. I love it. I actually crawl into the loft space just to watch like all the lights blinking on the battery system. We run off of air source for our heating and hot water.
Well, what's that?
So we're basically, the way that it works is kind of an inverse of a air cooler system. So it is a set of really massive fans, and inside there's a chemical that has a really low boiling point. So the fans use a little bit of electricity to get them going. It then sucks the air through the system. The warmth in the air heats the chemicals, which then heats the hot water that goes around our house. So that powers all our radiators and our hot water system. So it works up to minus 20 degrees. So even in the height of winter, that's how we get our hot water and our heating around the house. So we are entirely, we rely on mains, water supply and drainage, and we use Wi-Fi, but otherwise we're kind of off grid. I grow most of our food from kind of March through to October time. The rest of the time we get it from a local farm. All of this is amazing. I have only been able to do it because I had a really well-paid job in media. I wouldn't be able to go and do that now. Yeah. And I think the trouble that we have is, yes, it's incredibly exciting, but it's only available to the minority of people. And true. Ultimately, we've all got roof space, whether we own our property, whether we're in social housing, there's all roof space. But actually, I don't think it's the responsibility of those individual homeowners to put solar up there. I think it's the responsibility of the government to do so, because there are very few proportion of our country that could actually afford to do that.
Yes, though the government don't have any money, so no. I mean they only have our money, so we're paying for it anyway. It's taxed, so it's another payment, another tax payment. So yeah, I'm not sure how that quite works, but yeah, it's definitely the way. It definitely feels like it's exciting, though, doesn't it, to move forward? Right? Do you have faith in the human race to sort these problems out?
I have massive faith in the human race. This is why I built a people-centric organization. I mean, I put faith in people every single day when they come and make our products for us. And I believe the collective power that we can all have together is phenomenal. So yeah, and I think for me, the climate crisis and social equality come hand in hand, which is why I'm kind of pushing for both in our company.
As soon as I said I had an electric car, someone said to me, I just thought I'd get one because I don't use it very much. I thought I might as well do it that way. And immediately people said, oh, yeah, but the batteries, they're worse for the environment. And I'm like, okay. But I did go diesel. And so in fairness, they got a point because everyone told me to go diesel. And I went diesel. And then I found out that was horrific. So I got rid of that. And, you know, I'm trying to do my bit because you know, I have some money. So I try and make sure I spend it in the right way and wisely. And as soon as I said I was getting solar, somebody said to me, yeah, but the battery, you know, getting rid of the battery is worse than that is et cetera. And you're like, there's always the anti, isn't there? The anti movement who don't want to move in this direction.
I don't know if it's, I mean, it's not just a question of an anti movement. It's also the jury is out on so many topics. So yeah, electric vehicles, you know, the source of materials that makes batteries more effective. Right now, it seems like the ultimate source is in the seabed. So there is drilling about to start, you know, more towards America, which then the seabed captures all our carbon. That's going to release problems. But if you look at the carbon emissions on a day-to-day basis of a diesel vehicle versus an electric vehicle, do they weigh themselves up? And I think the challenge is actually is less about those anti-groups and more about the fact that we just don't have enough knowledge. But that shouldn't stop us from doing it. It shouldn't stop us from keep trying different things if we're all kind of moving in the right direction of trying to combat this collectively.
Yeah. I was reading just now before we came on air, I thought I'd do a bit of research and before I chat with you. And in America, actually, this is just a bit of knowledge here. Once 5% of new car sales go fully electric, everything changes, apparently, according to Bloomberg analysis of the 19 countries that have made the EV pivot. America have just hit 5%, which means they sort of connected to the smartphone. When 5% of the population got the smartphone, then it went wildfire and it went through. And this is happening over here. And interestingly, all my friends are going electric car. So they're all thinking about it and talking about hybrids and everything else. One of the reasons I went electric was mine was a hybrid thing, and it kept kicking from electric back into fuel, gas, petrol. And every time it went to petrol, it was like really boring and sluggish. And every time it went electric, I felt like I was in Tron. It was like, dim, 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 and I thought, I want that all the time.
I love that your kind of motivation for your kind of lifestyle responsibility is like, makes you feel like aerodynamic, makes you feel like a kind of forward-thinking superhero. I think it's brilliant.
But that's the way it should be. The modern way is actually more exciting. That's the thing. All these people holding on to, I love an engine car. They're boring. They're sluggish. The electric car. I think electric cars go faster now, don't they?
What surprises me about electric cars is that they actually have missed out on an opportunity, because they are silent, but no one really wants a silent car. Like, petrolheads really want one that sounds like impressive. Why they don't have like a range of personalized like car sounds for electric cars, so that you can basically amplify the sound of a Lamborghini
drive a Mini but sound like a Lamborghini.
Yeah, exactly.
That sort of thing. That could be it.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, the thing about being confused, though, which I think is interesting, is so a lot of, I'm on a WhatsApp group. A lot of my mates, they're like, oh yeah, electric. They've got a conscience, so they're talking a lot. They've all got children. They're talking a lot about having electric cars and things like that. Yeah. You know, every night they're barbecuing, and it's like, mate, you're literally burning fossil fuels in your garden, because I don't think people are, and they've got fire pits, and you're like, you're literally burning carbon every night, lots of it. You know, why was the point in having an electric car? And then it's constant weekends away on aeroplanes. And I'm like, you know, I'm not saying it's the wrong thing. It's just the thing that we're doing now. And I think there's a lot of confusion that I think people perceive barbecues as very healthy for the environment and fire pits. They're, you know, you're at one with nature, yet. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm right, and you're literally burning carbon. And I think with barbecues, the charcoal's coming from very hardwood trees, because they're the best ones for charcoal. So,
yeah.
You know, if you are doing it, by the way, you should look for sustainable wood, really. But I don't think it's anyone's fault. I think people are just so bloody confused about what we're doing, don't you think?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of confusion, but I think we also need to be very careful that we're not expecting everybody to change everything overnight, because that's the mindset that won't be sustainable. So the example that you gave, if somebody swaps their fuel car for an electric car but has an occasional barbecue, surely that's better than them, you know, not changing anything at all. And I think we just need to be really careful about not layering on too much guilt associated with making good climate decisions, because guilt won't be a good motivator, and it certainly won't keep people on the path of trying to live the most responsible life they can. There is a lot of confusion, and I don't think that that's going to change in the immediate future, unless there is just a general kind of education project that gets done at all stages, where we can help people make informed decisions to say, okay, if you make this choice, this is kind of your contribution to the kind of carbon reduction. If you make this choice, this is the bigger impact that you can have, rather than, yeah, layering on the guilt to kind of stop people doing things.
I think that I 100% agree with you. 100%. Though I do think we need to be putting the responsibility back to people via where they're buying their stuff. So we look at a supermarket, and we maybe start thinking, okay, single use plastic, not great. So let's get it to the same price. Let's put a carbon tax on it. Let's get it to a little bit more expensive than mushroom packaging. And then they can pass it on to the consumer, and the consumer go, hold on, I don't want my strawberries to cost 12 quid, you know, and they go, oh, well, you get it in the mushroom one, they cost, you know, 6 quid or something. And it's like, maybe we need to go to the airplane companies and and say to them, you need to add tax into like a carbon tax. If, you know, if people are flying 10, 20 times a year, then they need to maybe be paying some carbon tax. You know, maybe we need to go to all these different, if you're buying charcoal and cutting down trees, maybe you need to pay the money that it costs to put the tree up. Do you know what I mean? Maybe that's, rather than putting the emphasis constantly back on the consumer to make the decisions, maybe we need to start putting the sort of like a carbon tax and as a global one. I mean, nothing will ever happen globally, by the way, but just in a pipe dream, it might do. But do you not think then I can make an informed decision because I know that I'm paying for a carbon tax on top of what I'm doing?
I think the first two stages of what you described, I think, are really smart. I think the part where it gets passed on to the consumer is the part where that approach for me breaks down, because ultimately that only protects the profit margins of those large organizations that are behind the production of these goods. And actually they should be the ones bearing the burden of the environmental cost of what they're producing. The other challenge that we've got is that at the moment, particularly in the UK, being green is a middle-class privilege. It's not something that's accessible to everybody. So if we automatically just chuck an extra couple of quid on something, that's actually only going to hurt the people like who aren't, you know, that don't have the highest income bracket. So I think it needs to be absorbed more back into the organizations. I think I was listening to one of your prior episodes on donut economics, and there was a discussion in there that really resonates with me, which is this idea that actually the profit, that the letting companies continue to build profit for profit's sake, we can't continue to do that. We have to have this kind of purpose-driven core that runs through organizations. And that means that the largest corporations actually should take a hit on how much profit they make if it means that we can change the processes of manufacture or change the type of packaging they're using. Because ultimately, the only reason they need to keep building profit is to keep pleasing their shareholders. And that doesn't actually help the masses of people on a global scale that are affected by the climate crisis.
Yeah, so you're saying don't pass it on to the consumer, but the companies take it out of their profits to make it a better environment.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I've learned something there. Yeah, that's actually a good idea, because I don't think any of us would worry if someone shareholders didn't get any more profit, yeah, would they? Apart from the poor ones, they deserve it. Yeah, they deserve it. Interesting talking about, just because I was doing my bit of research just now, about if you have faith in humans. At MIT, they think they found a way to reverse climate change. This is one of those things where they've just put out a tiny little snippet, and one of the papers has picked up on it and decided this is something we're going to go with. We're years away from it, but the idea involves creating several thin filmed like silicon bubbles that sit in space. They're calling space bubbles. And they sit there, and they about the size of Brazil, and the bubbles would provide an extra buffer against the harmful solar radiation that comes from the sun. I don't need you to comment on that. I just thought it's funny that we're looking for these way out of their solutions, putting bubbles up. And so, I mean, you know me, I want to live in the future. So, you know, I'd love to see space bubbles. I think that would be exciting. I just can't wait for the aliens to land personally, but you know, I do think I live in a sci-fi movie, but you know, it's interesting. I do think we need to encourage governments to back scientists to move it forward. Do you not think that, like, all the products, all the way that you're putting your products in all these, you know, the packaging, someone's got to develop that, hasn't it? And I think that's where it would be a good opportunity to spend money.
Yeah, absolutely. And the only way that we're going to get out of this situation is a collective effort of like innovation, reduction in current lifestyles and kind of expectations of how we should consume things, and those two then meet in the middle. And that is completely driven by innovation in all sorts of kind of climate tech, from space bubbles, which I think sound awesome, through to, you know, seaweed technology. There's some fantastic things that are happening with seaweed farms in New Zealand, where they're capturing carbon and then they're using that seaweed to turn into kind of packaging with the carbon contained within it. And, you know, there's all sorts of incredible innovation, but it has to be both. It has to be innovation and it has to be kind of en masse lifestyle changes, and those two meet in the middle.
Yeah, exactly right. I like the fact that all that stuff we used to, you remember we used to have all those plastic bits come to package everything, and now you've got those ones that you could stick in the sink and pour water on. And yeah. It means they go down. That's just become commonplace now, hasn't it? So it doesn't take long. I assume they're good for the environment, those ones, better than the plastic bits they used to put in. But it's just become commonplace, hasn't it, to see those things now. They're just there when you get your packaging, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, those cornstarch packing filler, we use it as well. It's made just from corn, basically. And so, yeah, you can dissolve it. You can put it in your compost. You can use it to make kind of models, as my kids do at the weekends. But right. You say that it's commonplace, but that's probably the single largest inquiry we get from customers who receive a package from us. And they'll say, I thought you were a plastic-free company, but you filled your boxes with plastic. And, you know, we write back to them and say, no, it's made from corn, just dissolve it. So I don't think it's as widespread knowledge as you would think, because these are people that are already interested in the environment and they found it a new product. So I think that it's actually proliferating slowly, but these type of things take a while to be picked up, understood, and then expected.
Okay. So that gets on to a point about your company then. So I suppose the biggest challenge for you now is awareness. The product's good. It looks good. It makes you feel good having it. You're living in the future like me. But you've got to get people to be aware of it. How do you go about awareness? Because that is the real challenge. And it's very, very costly because it's a crowded market, isn't it?
Incredibly costly. So we rely a lot on PR and press. So we've had some fantastic support from journalists who really believe in what we're doing. I think we kind of stand out from the crowd in the fact that we're such a principled organization and brand. We are increasingly seeing that lots of different people, whether they be journalists, content creators, influencers, really want to be associated with companies that are purpose-led. So we're probably over-indexing in the type of support that we get from them. We also rely very heavily on our home manufacturers being brand ambassadors, because they're going out into their own communities and they're proud of what they're producing, and they're telling their neighbours, and then their neighbours are then buying, you know, the goods they've made. And also the kind of word of mouth, you know, our Trustpilot reviews are outstanding. They're very emotive. In fact, there's a European-based pharmaceutical company that contacted us a little while ago, and they said to me, Amelia, how on earth have you got people to care passionately about cleaning their toilets and get emotional about cleaning their toilet? We've been trying to do that for years, and nobody will feel that way. And I think it's because people really understand the kind of impact we're trying to make with what we're making, and they then pass that passion on to their friends, and that's how we get kind of virality.
Are you just British-based at the moment?
We are British-based at the moment. We will be moving into new markets, but we will never export. So we will replicate the model that we've done here in the UK in the new markets that we're going to expand into.
Okay. That's very good. I was just actually in a conversation we were having earlier, I was just thinking it's really interesting every time you eat an avocado, it comes from halfway around the globe. And I do love them, but I've always wondered whether that was the right thing to do. But I don't know, it's where I don't think we can go backwards. We've had globalization and we expect things from all over the world, don't we? I mean, can we go backwards? Should we stop that? Should we just, you say you eat mainly for food from your own house, do you, and for your own land?
Yeah, so I'm vegan, so that's very helpful. But the rest of my family aren't. And actually, it's very strange because I carried all four of my children and yet they've all ended up being carnivores. I'm not quite sure how that's happened, but I'm giving them free choice for the moment until they can make their own decisions. But their meat that they eat comes within half a mile of our house. We're very lucky. We live in a rural area. So we walk to the farm. They meet the pigs, actually, before they collect the sausages. So they have a full understanding of the kind of full life cycle of the sausages that they're about to consume. But yes, I eat from our land, and I'm fortunate to be able to do that. We have a plastic-free policy in our house, and we also have a pre-loved only policy. So everything from clothes to children's toys and gifts are always secondhand. And we do eat bananas, but all other fruit, it has to be UK-based fruit, which the children are so angry with me about because they are so bored of apples and pears, particularly in the kind of autumn winter months.
I love apples. I always go for the one with the Union Jack on them. I always go for the package for those. I just think that's the one thing. British apples are great, so just eat them. I just found out the other day that they freeze dry them or something for 6 months or something like that when they store them, which which I didn't like a lot. But there you go. You say your children are carnivore. You mean omnivore, don't you? They because there are carnivore diets.
Well, they are omnivore. Yeah, they do. They eat everything.
Yeah, they eat vegetables and everything. Okay, cool.
It's more extreme for me to say carnivore as a vegan.
Carnivore. So, yeah. But there are those diets where those guys just eat meat only. I tried it once. I did it for about 10 days and felt ridiculous. I just mentally couldn't deal with it anymore. So I stopped doing it. I've tried all these diets on these podcasts. We're coming to the end of the hour. Just a couple more things with you. A lot of companies these days, they have political stance, political agendas. Do you feel you're going to be under pressure to do that? I mean, I was interested the other day when Ben and Jerry's made a political comment about someone and someone replied, "You're an ice cream," which just really amused me. Why are you making a comment? You're an ice cream. But Ben and Jerry's, obviously, these days it's seen you've got to have political leanings and choose your you choose. Is that something that you've become aware of? Will you be getting involved politically?
I think the simple answer is no, partly because at the moment I have such little faith in politics. I wouldn't personally align with one particular party, and historically I have. I think as a company, the most important thing for us to do is to keep espousing our values, which is inclusivity, you know, taking a non-judgmental view of people and trying to opening our doors to as many people as possible. If that at some point aligns with some political party, that's, you know, circumstantial. It will never be a deliberate move on our part.
So what does the future look like for you? I assume one of the major aspects, the thing that you keep picking up on, which I understand and I agree with, is that it costs money to be environmentally friendly. So I suppose that's, you want costs to come down so that everybody can get involved in this. I suppose that's one of the things, is that you see a future?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a really transparent attitude to showing how our business operates. So during Black Friday last year, we told everybody how much each product cost and where that money went, how much went to the home manufacturer, how much is on packaging, how much goes back into the business. When other brands were kind of pushing their prices up in January, we held off as long as we possibly could. We had to push our prices up slightly 2 weeks ago. We were very transparent about how much and why, and that was mostly around raw ingredient costs. As we grow as an organization, our hope is that we can actually reduce the pricing, which is really odd for a brand to say, but we actually want our products to become cheaper over time so that more people can afford to buy them. We're really fortunate that because we don't use any plastics, we don't use any chemicals associated with the petrol industry, where there's been huge price rises and kind of fluctuations with anything related to oil, we haven't had to do that. So when we look at forecasting going forward, our margin can increase, but it also means that we can reduce our costs over time that we pass on to end consumers.
Yeah, I was looking at you on Instagram. I thought you did a little story about how you're having to put your price up. And I thought it was really interesting that actually the owner of the company is communicating with the consumer. Richard Branson did that so well for so many years, didn't he? Where the face of the company actually is a person. Is that something you think you'll continue with throughout the longevity of the company the whole time?
It's like you've been a fly on the wall of our weekly meetings. I constantly ask them to remove me from Instagram and other channels as much as possible. When we started out, it was me running everything and I was basically the face of the brand, and I don't want that to be the case going forward. The main reason being I'm white, female, in her 40s, middle class, gay. I'm not representative of everybody, and I don't really want there to be one single kind of persona that's associated with us as an organization. So I will always be transparent and available. I hope that I will be less kind of featured in social media, for example, on a go forward basis. But that's a debate that happens week in, week out.
Yeah, though you're smart and you obviously understand the cause, and you understand your products, you understand what you're doing, and it's passionate. And I've learned lots today. So in the last hour, you've taught me things. So there's not a problem that you're just one person. You can only be one person, but I quite like what you're hearing. So I enjoyed it. Is that a problem? I'm not sure it is a problem that you're the face of it.
I don't know. I would. So from my personal experience, you know, growing up as a gay girl and not ever seeing lesbian women on TV or media or celebrities or personalities, I always found it really difficult that I wasn't represented. And I think I've taken that on board a lot. And I think very carefully about I don't want to limit the reach that we can have by having me kind of the visual brand image. So I think that there is perfect opportunity for me to be vocal and have these kind of discussions that you and I are having. I just don't know that I necessarily need to have my face on everything that we're doing. And so I think over time, I think I will win out against the rest of the team in having that kind of honored.
Yeah,
we'll see.
Interestingly, I used to do a show called Soccer M, and I was the producer of it, and I used to write it with the guys and girls. But I remember trying to get as many northern voices and northern people on the show as possible, because I thought the world was sick of hearing people like me, Londonish sort of Mockney accents, whatever the hell I have, you know. And I think that partly the success of it was we had people from the Northeast, people from the Midlands, people from the Northwest, people from Ireland, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think everyone could identify with it. So I think you're right, and you're definitely onto something there. I think that's key to it, to make sure people can see themselves in your product. Amelia, thank you so much for joining me today. I've really thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. If people want to get their sample packet, remind us again, they need to go to buyplanet.com.
.com.
And if they want to follow and look at all the videos of you on Instagram, is it just Bide Planet or is it Bide?
That's right. You catch those videos of me before I start removing myself. Get in while you can. I think actually, if you look back, there have been so many moments of me in baths and showers and various other, like, yeah. So if you want to see those, do it now before they go and be a part of our history.
Yeah, it's very good. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim.